And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, hello, hello. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio. And welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552. Or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. For over four decades, the contributions of John Sebastian have become a permanent part of our American musical fabric. His group, The Lovin' Spoonful, played a major role in the mid-60s rock revolution. But what leader, singer, and songwriter Sebastian had in mind was actually a counter-revolution. We were grateful to the Beatles for reminding us our rock and roll roots, John explains, but we wanted to cut out the English middlemen, so to speak, and get down to making the new music as an American band. This, The Loving Spoonful did like nobody before or since, putting their first seven singles into the top 10. This was unprecedented and utterly unthinkable at the height of Beatlemania. At first, they'd taken older material from blues, country, folk, and jug band sources, what we know now as roots music, and made it sound modern. Then in a series of original songs composed and sung by John Sebastian, they did the reverse, creating thoroughly modern music that sounded like it contained the entire history of American music, which it did. You know the songs by heart. You Believe in Magic, You Didn't Have to Be So Nice, Daydream, my favorite, Younger Girl, Did You Ever Have to Make Up Your Mind, Summer in the City, number one hit, Rain on the Roof, Nashville Cats, 6 O'Clock, Darling Be Home Soon, Younger Generation. These songs did more than simply answer the British invasion. They carried the musical tradition into the future. This music had an immediate and incredible impression on the public consciousness, but John Sebastian was already a name well known to the connoisseurs. He was born March 17, 1944, in New York City. His father was a noted classical harmonica player, and his mother a writer of radio programs. Regular visitors to the family Greenwich Village home included Burl Ives and Woody Guthrie. So it was no surprise when a young John and a participant in the folk music revival that swept the nation in the 50s. As a member of Even Dozen Jug Band, his skills on guitar, harmonica, and auto harp soon made him a sought-after accompanist on the village folk scene, working with Fred Neil, Tim Hardin, Mississippi John Hurt, Judy Collins, Bob Dylan, and many others. So The Lovin' Spoonful was not his first act, and it certainly wasn't his last. After leaving the group he founded, he bore witness to another turn of the musical zeitgeist with his performance at massive festivals like Woodstock and its English equivalent, the Isle of Wight. He had been involved in music for films, most notably Francis Ford Coppola's You're a Big Boy Now and Woody Allen's What's Up, Tiger Lily, and Broadway. But when producers of a TV show called Welcome Back, Cotter commissioned a theme song in 1976, Sebastian's Welcome Back became a chart-topping solo record. Throughout the 70s and 80s, he continued to record and tour, pleasing old fans and winning new ones. There's no telling how many aspiring musicians have been nurtured by his instruction books for harmonica and guitar, but he aimed to inspire an even younger audience with the publication in 1993 of the delightful children's book, J.B.'s Harmonica. The 90s also saw John return to the group format with the J-Band, a contemporary celebration of his jug band heritage. The acclaim the group received was gratifying, bittersweet. The group's albums contained some of the most and last recorded performances of blues pioneer Yank Rachel and wash-tub jug virtuoso Fritz Richmond. Thankfully, John's induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2000 hasn't slowed him down. Whether the stage is at Carnegie Hall or a folk festival in some far-flung locale, John is still out there spreading his gospel of American roots music. He was the subject of the PBS special, Do You Believe in Magic? The Music of John Sebastian, and has had duets with David Grisman. He has also lent his music in support of social, environmental, and animal rights causes. John is also a welcome media presence. His community insights and anecdotes and stories are regularly featured in print, radio, TV, and film documentary projects. John Sebastian is not only a master musician, writer, and performer, he remains one of the best ambassadors American music has ever had. It's my great pleasure today to welcome singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and Rock and Roll Hall of Famer John Sebastian to the Ray Shasho Show. Hello, John!
Hello, Ray. That introduction was exhausting.
I know. I'm tired.
I felt like there was time passing. I looked out the window, and it was like one of those time-lapse photographies. You know, people go nighttime. Anyway, it's good to talk to you. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, I do these intros because, you know, we post these on YouTube. We post them on iTunes. And anytime, you know, somebody wants to do research, especially the younger crowd, I just want to fill them in from the beginning.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. Now I'm so, pulling you.
Yeah. Away. That makes sense.
Coming to Florida, pal.
That's right, man. I've got your tour dates. I got your tour dates right in front of me, March 7th. You'll be at Largo, at the Largo Cultural Center, which is one of my stomping grounds. March 8th at Delray Beach at the Crest Theater.
Yes.
March 10th at Sanibel, Florida, at Big Arts.
Yum.
The 13th and 14th, you'll be in Naples. Beautiful down there in Naples, not too far from me, at the Theater Zone. So, welcome to Florida.
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, thanks very much. You know, I spent a lot of time down there as a kid because about 1950, my grandparents moved to Lake Worth. So I'd be down in Lake Worth for about as long as I could stretch for that Christmas vacation.
Awesome. You're also going to be performing some other places as well. They can go right to your website to see. But you're also coming to my old stomping grounds. I was born and raised in Baltimore and grew up in D.C. So on September 9th, you'll be in Baltimore at Susie's Cause Bluegrass and Folk Festival.
Looking forward to it.
That'll be awesome. I had some of your buddies on recently on my show. I had John Hall, who I think you did No Nukes with, right?
That's right.
I've had Rick Roberts.
I played his various political campaign stops. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a good guy. He's a good guy. Nice guy. Rick Roberts was on the show recently, and Jesse Colin Young, who's I've had several times the pleasure of talking with, and he's another great guy. Love
and
Jesse.
He and I go way, way back. I think I'm on his first solo album.
You guys actually were part of the Greenwich Village scene. Also, you played a lot of the clubs over there together, yeah.
Yeah, and he also has a connection with Felix Pappalardi, who as a bassist, but also a general production and arranging force. It was terrific. I think that might have been my connection to Jesse in the first place. No, wait, maybe Eric Jacobson. Well, right in there. It was funny because he was still Perry Miller. But he was making albums, and I was playing on them.
You know, you were actually born in Greenwich Village, is that right?
Yes.
How cool is that, man? Talk about being in the right place at the right time.
That's one of the most impossible things to answer.
so many great musicians came out of there. You know, I've talked to Maria Muldaur, she's cool. After all these years, I was able to say, Maria, I had the biggest crush on you back in the day.
That's right.
Oh, she's awesome. And you played with her husband, ex-husband, I guess.
And continue to, and looking forward to a few very jug bandy dates where we don't even do any Spoonful tunes. Don't be afraid, Florida. Calm down now. I'm just saying that we might do that sometime in the future.
Awesome.
And, he and I and Jim Queskin, who, of course, is our fearless leader, going back to the jug band in the 60s in Cambridge, the Queskin
right.
band. So, anyway, things seem to be popping.
Awesome.
And, yeah.
You know, jug band music is fun, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and part of the reason it's fun is that there's room for certain mournfulness, sadness. Mm-hmm. People kind of go, you know, it's just like ragtime, don't worry, nobody
right.
gets hurt. But there's a couple of those tunes that are incredibly soulful and sad and speak of things that we as modern people really don't have to cope with.
Yeah. What's the definition of a jug band? Does that mean it just has some homemade instruments in the band? And I guess it started out with the jug way back when? Or
you know, it's one more African-American tradition that
right.
we've all come to appreciate. And it did have its dawnings in places like Brownsville, Tennessee, and Louisville,
Kentucky. Yeah,
that's right. And Memphis too, of course, was a recording spot for a lot of those guys. And it was a blues-based,
right,
kind of a loose aggregation. And in many of our favorite recordings, which kind of go over a lapse of time, after all, different members come to the fore. You know, suddenly we realize that the harmonica player is a great songwriter. And so there's people like Noah Lewis and Will Shade in those jug bands that were just really, really deep, soulful songwriters.
And a lot of legendary bands, including yourself, started out with in the jug band format. Like you started out and then brought it over to the Loving Spoonful, of course. And then Country Joe and the Fish, I guess, started out with a jug band. Mongo Jerry was another one.
Yeah.
And Jesse Colin Young, who had, I guess, Grizzly Bear was one of his hits, I guess, with the Youngbloods, which was a jug band standard. As well.
Interesting, yeah. And then I believe that song might have had its first recording with a group called Two Guys from Boston.
Hmm.
And that's where the Felix Pappalardi connection comes in, because he was the producer on that version of Grizzly Bear.
Huh. I didn't know that. I didn't know Felix was involved with that at all.
Another tiny detail.
Exactly.
Part of the puzzle.
and the Grateful Dead as well. Jerry Garcia and Bob Ware and were also part of that jug band scene, I guess, before the Grateful Dead. Is that right?
That's what I've heard.
They were in the Warlocks, I guess. I guess that was the name of the band, the Warlocks.
Yeah.
You've got such a great history, man. It's awesome. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Top 40 music. I was a Top 40 guy back in the late 70s. You know, I love the hits, you know, and not too many groups can say they had so many hits during the Beatle era. The other guy that comes to mind, I talked to Tommy James. I talked to Gary Lewis from the Playboys, who I think you and the... the Spoonful had probably as many hits together back in the 60s during the Beatle era.
Yeah,
which is amazing, you know. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of bands back in the 60s, they couldn't evolve into the 70s, you know. You know, I'm talking about bands like the Zombies and, you know, but, you know, like Tommy James had, you know, Crimson and Clover when he got into the 70s, and that was his big transition period.
Yeah,
so that was a tough transition from going from 60s and 70s for a lot of bands, I guess.
I loved his book.
Yeah, yeah. Which one, Tommy James or?
Yeah, Tommy James' book.
Oh, yeah, Me, the Mob, and the Music?
Yeah.
You know, I was going to ask you about that, because you... Because the 11 Spoonful, you guys were, you were on, what was the label you guys were on?
Yeah, Kama Sutra.
Kama Sutra, which had...
essentially going to turn into Buddha, going to turn
right.
into MGM.
So, wasn't there a few mob ties with Kama Sutra at the time?
Well, I think they had to clean it up when they got their association with MGM.
Right.
Because, yeah, MGM kind of went, you know, guys... We can't have DJs ending up in alleys. Now come on, we can't have that. So I guess they were. We were always one step away. Let's say, I mean, Tommy James' stories are really funny, and I don't have anything to compare to that.
Right.
Sure, we were into swimming in shark-infested waters, and parts of us were left behind in the shark-infested waters. But I can't say that we were ever, I never felt any kind of pressure from a mob guy or anything like that.
Did you ever run into Morris Levy?
I never did.
You never did. Lucky you.
I think so.
I mean, he even threatened John Lennon. I mean, that's amazing story there. Yeah, great. Like you said, it was a great book.
Yeah.
Now, another amazing thing about you, your godmother was Vivian Vance.
That's right. My mom's best friend for
right.
Pretty much her whole life was. Yeah, it was Vivian, and Viv would come and visit us when, in her earlier life, Mom was writing, funny stuff for her. And,
right.
And then she had some success, and Mom ended up writing more funny stuff for, Tonight Show appearances, stuff like that. Of course, once Viv really started in on the Lucy show, we had very limited times to see her.
Right.
But in her earlier life, she'd come up with her husband for many years was an actor named Phil Ober, who used to play angry bosses on all of those shows.
Right.
Lucy's and other shows. It was always his job. And then later on, she was married to a guy named John Dodds and living in Connecticut. And so we had actually, that was a nice time because we were able to go and spend time with her and laugh a lot because it was always funny.
I've talked to the guys, the Livingstons from My Three Sons, Stanley and Barry, and they were good friends with William Frawley because they were, William Frawley was on My Three Sons and some of the stories about William Frawley. They were sent to the Brown Derby to bring him back on the set because he liked to drink a little too much.
That's right, and that's why he and Viv eventually. Did not get along because Viv just was impossibly impatient with a guy who wouldn't do his job, sober. So, obviously they needed him. He was hilarious. He was funny. He had that gift. It's from vaudeville where he just moved funny. So.
Thing, I don't think Vivian Vance was too happy that William Frawley was a lot older than she was too, right?
They were very often kind of weighting her down, and they did not want to give her the glamour that for most of her life there on that show she had. They had to kind of what would you call when you're dumbing down makeup? I don't know what the term is there. But, you know, that was sort of what the game was.
Yeah. You know, I had Lucy Arnaz on the show recently.
Yeah.
And that was pretty cool, you know, just talking about her and her mom and, her, of course, her dad. My mom was Cuban, so we hit it off real good.
Good.
My house was a little bit like hers.
So you know where to eat in Miami.
I do. Anywhere in Little Havana, I recommend.
I haven't missed in Little Havana. And, you know, I'm only there as a tourist, so I usually don't know the coolest or the hippest, but boy, oh boy, I wasn't doing bad just as a walk-in guy.
So you must like Cuban food then, huh?
I do.
Yeah, it's awesome. I could eat it every day. You know, hats off again to your dad. Your dad was wonderful. You know, he's the guy who turned the harp into a classical, I guess they say classical chromatic harmonica.
That's right. Well, the chromatic already existed, but Dad had a lot to do, actually, just in the physical instrument end of it, with developing that, what they call the 64 chromatic. It's a 64-hole instrument when you add up all the holes that the button gives you. And, yes, but you know, the hell with that. He was this remarkable artist, and it's just one of the mysteries of my life to see how did this guy escape the public, you know, some real adulation. I mean, he had approval, wonderfully so, in Europe and... But in America, the instrument was the problem.
Yeah.
People could not think of the harmonica in that regard. But it's lucky that Villa-Lobos didn't have any problems. Cherubin didn't have any problems imagining it. So good things happened in that regard. And it's one of those kind of things that somebody's going to discover someday and say, oh, my God, here
I
is.
I know.
I've never heard this instrument this way.
That is pretty amazing what he's done. You know, he's definitely a pioneer, you know, of what he's done. He actually soloed at the Kennedy Center, right?
Oh yeah. And he played with symphony orchestras up and down the United States and across the country. Went to Europe, played the big halls, played Milano, played Berlin, played on and on.
Wow.
He was regarded very, very highly in Germany and Italy and France.
So you learned a lot from your dad as far as your harmonica playing, pretty much?
Well, although he was not a guy who was going to push the instrument on me and say, be a harmonica player, because he just wasn't that kind of guy. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, when you hear somebody rehearse 6-8 hours a day, you're taking in information. You can't you can't avoid it.
Yep.
And so that was a wonderful thing to have his great playing as a resource to have in my head to know some of the physicality of the instrument. It was really valuable, gave me a tremendous head start in little old Greenwich Village when suddenly people said, you know, we need a harmonica player, but we don't know Sonny Terry's phone number. And so,
You're an amazing harp player. You are fantastic. And one of your heroes, I think, was it Lightning Hopkins?
Absolutely. And I just found out Ringo Starr came to Houston. He was going to try to, like, live there so he could hear Lightning Hopkins. I love this. I never heard this stuff, and I found it on somebody sent it to me. And there it is. Really interesting. He tried to get a job. I think he was trying to get a job in a meatpacking you know, one of those meatpacking situations, you know, and they go, this, you know, this little guy, oh, fuck, you know, he's going to get eaten up by one of these machines. I'm sorry. He's going to get eaten up by one of these machines. Luckily, he got fired, had to go home, and that was right about the time when, I don't know, Rory Storm or whoever it was giving up the ghost, and the Beatles were starting or something like that. So
yeah, he was amazing. Lightning Hopkins is amazing. Another Jesse Colin Young, also friends of Lightning Hopkins, and also Tony Joe White, who I interviewed. I'm sure.
Tony Joe White, yeah.
Tony Joe's a good guy. I wanted to talk a little bit, of course, about The Spoonful. There is a band out there called The Spoonful with some of your ex-bandmates out there.
Yes.
And of course, yeah, they're still doing some touring and whatever.
Yes.
Yeah. The band name, did that originate, was that inspired from some lines of, you know, from Mississippi John Hurt? That's what I've heard.
Yes, it was.
The Coffee Blues.
That's right.
And let's see, I guess, was it, it was suggested by, Jeff Muldaur and maybe Fritz Richmond?
It was suggested by Fritz Richmond, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And let's see, what was I going to say here? Your producer, Eric Jacobson. What was it like working with him?
Wonderful guy. I still call him. I still send him little copies of whatever I'm doing. And try to visit whenever I'm out there near him in Northern California. And he's one of the kind of another guy who people did not realize the depth of this guy's skills.
Right.
It was lucky for me because everybody said, oh, that's all the Love and Spoonful doing that. It was. But we had three or four layers of it to be able to do with a guy like that who was that skilled at at overdubbing.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of our things we would figure out a way to if a guitar sounds too much like a guitar, let's overdub chimes so that the guitar sounds chimey. But let's don't turn the chimes up loud enough that you can tell they're chimes.
Yep.
I mean, that's sort of the little piece of Jacobson magic that he was capable of putting together.
Man, a great producer goes a long way in a band. You know, I mean, like George Martin did with the Beatles, and, you know, Todd Rundgren has done so many great albums. I think that's what really makes you and breaks you. I mean, the band's got lots of talent, but I think everybody needs that, you know, that help.
That production skill, yeah.
That production skills, yeah, and engineering skills as well. Here, I want to put some rumors to rest here. Danny Gatton, did he inspire Nashville Gats?
Yes, he did.
He did.
No, I've talked about it on stage a lot of times.
Okay.
That's why it's, I don't know if it's even, does it qualify as a rumor if people talk to more than 300 people at a time about it? I don't know.
Well, but, I haven't heard you say that live yet, so.
we did discover later that this guy that we encountered playing in a bar was Danny in an early incarnation. I know he's not from there, but that was where we met him, and we didn't even meet him. We just heard him and got so discouraged we went to our hotel rooms and teared up.
Yeah, being from D.C., I was, you know, Danny Gatton and guys like Roy Buchanan were legends in the D.C. area. You know, great guitar players.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's such a shame that these guys weren't able to continue, you know.
Absolutely.
They both had tragic endings, unfortunately.
Terrible.
Yeah. Here's another one. At the peak of the band's your success, were you guys actually looked upon becoming the Monkees? Before the Monkees were the Monkees on that show.
There was suggestions of that
okay.
at a certain point.
Right.
But as I relayed to Stephen when he was writing his book later,
right.
I had hardly any memory of it. It was a thing that I kind of like attended a meeting and
right.
went, oh yeah, they want to buy us. They want to, you know, have us do this. And
mm-hmm.
but who would want to do that? Especially if you're actually writing your own stuff
right.
and you
right.
were a good band without
exactly.
hiring Al Blaine. I mean,
yeah.
think of the triple session fees, fellas. Think of them.
Yeah. Yeah, you didn't need to do that. The Monkees needed to do that, yes. You know, because they were kind of a manufactured band in the beginning. And I always questioned, you know, they turned down Don Kirshner for Sugar Sugar. And the Archies, he put together another fabricated band, the Archies, and they made a lot of money from that. And then the Monkees went into making Head, which was an okay album, you know, it wasn't bad at all. But they never, you know, after Head, that was it for the Monkees.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which is a shame. But that's what they wanted. I guess they wanted to play their own instruments and, you know, get that credibility.
Yeah. Hey, Ray, I got to get to some home stuff here.
Okay.
Pretty soon.
All right. What is your impression of Ed Sullivan's show, playing the Ed Sullivan show and then playing Woodstock? Now, there's been a lot of...
Well, now, wait, let's not connect too many dots all at once here. It's a very, very different experience. And,
yep.
and of course, so I'll go Ed Sullivan first because it happened
okay.
first. We
okay.
were all getting ready to be all sarcastic and who cares about the Ed Sullivan show? And Ed's a big square, and he doesn't know anything about us, and
right,
he doesn't
right.
care. And then, before we actually do our thing, he comes out with the best endorsement I've ever heard and mm. absolutely nails what our intent was. This whole idea of, you know, this is
yeah.
an American band, and we're not imitating, and so on. So that just was a wonderful thing that happened.
So you had a good experience, because a lot of bands, he didn't even pronounce their names right. You know?
No, that was really a nice situation.
Good.
For the Spoonful, and
yeah.
we had no complaints. They asked back again and again, and it probably made us visible in the United States, period.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he brought all the greats. He really did. He brought all the greats to the, you know, to the mainstream. You know,
well,
without Ed,
yeah.
I don't think a lot of bands would have gotten there.
Woodstock.
When did you actually play Woodstock? Was it after
Saturday.
Richie Havens?
Saturday.
On
no,
Saturday.
Richie was on Friday.
Right.
I was sometime in the afternoon on Saturday. Because it had rained, and mm-hmm. I had ended up on stage just as I was a spectator at that show. I didn't even have an instrument, and they suddenly came up with this idea that in order to continue being able to have music on the stage, they could only have an acoustic act. And
right.
They just sort of turned around and said, yeah. You're on. And I went, hey, wait a minute now. I don't even have an instrument. I didn't bring anything. They said, well, you have 5 minutes to find one. And I actually went and borrowed an instrument from Timmy Harden, who,
mm-hmm.
as you know, was
yep.
a past cohort. And yeah, so...
That's amazing.
That was, you know, really the coolest thing about that was the audience, though.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember who
not unlike our recent march here this last weekend.
Mm-hmm.
It's is.
Do you remember who you followed that night, that day?
It could have been Joe Cocker might have bookended me one way or the other.
Okay.
He might have gone on after, because then they would have had to put up. They'd had time to sweep the stage. That was the main thing, was that while I was playing, they were going to sweep the stage. And then they were going to be able to put electricity back on there.
And you played just with an acoustic guitar. It was just you on stage.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
That's amazing, in front of all those people. I talked to Melanie, and when Melanie got on stage, her mom drove her to Woodstock. And when she got on stage, she said she was in, it was like an out-of-body experience. She didn't even remember playing music.
Sure, I'm not surprised. Yeah.
Yep. The
still here, you.
You're still here. I'm here, too. Burl Ives, you know, when you think of Christmas, you always think of Burl Ives every year. Now, did you have a close relationship with Burl?
No, I was too young to really know anything about anything, really. I've got to remember that these are, years when I was maybe five or so that Burl was around, and this was before any of those kind of successes, both as a pop singer and also later as an actor. Of course, I knew, hey, wait, that's the guy who used to come over to our house, but I certainly didn't see him in that part of his life.
Yeah, he was an amazing performer, and, you know, nobody had a voice like him, you know. I mean, every year when you think about Christmas, it's Burl Ives.
Yep.
Yeah. No, a lot of people don't know how many different other albums that you played on. I mean, you played harmonica with the Doors. You were on Roadhouse Blues, correct, from Morrison Hotel? Did a lot of stuff with the Doors.
That was also with Lonnie Mack. I mean, the Doors, great, but hey, Lonnie Mack, please.
Lonnie Mack, That's amazing. And also you played with Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And did they actually ask you to join the band before Neil Young?
Kind of. There was an afternoon where we were kind of talking about it. Nobody it's an idea that over time has gained purchase that I never would have expected. It was like, oh, we could do that. Oh, yeah, or we could go smoke a joint and think about what we're going to have for lunch. It wasn't really a big focus.
Well, it could have came to fruition. You never know.
No, I really am happy that idea didn't really have legs. I
really,
frankly, had already made a move from a band to a solo career. I did not myself believe that I had the push to be able to move an audience one more time into another unit.
Mm-hmm. And your solo career was great. I like Tarzana Kid. You had a lot of different artists that you always brought in on your albums, like Lowell George, Phil Everly, which is awesome. And you actually considered kind of a super band, right, with Lowell George and Phil Everly at one time?
Again, it was a briefly considered idea by Lowell, mainly. Yeah, I don't
by
think
Lowell.
We would have presumed to have that idea. It was just that Phil and I were singing together a little bit, and I think that was probably where that idea came from, because Lowell and I were also writing a little bit during that period. So other things were overlapping, but I don't think anybody in Little Feet was going to just step aside and, oh, yeah, let's add two more guys and cut down on our price by, two guys. I don't think so.
You jammed with Hendrix, correct?
Yeah.
What did you – did you play harmonica with Hendrix or guitar?
No, it was just an afternoon, evening – in a studio around the corner from my house. So, I mean, it was so last minute and casual and just fun. And, you know, I knew Jimmy mainly through John Hammond. Really preceded any of that Jimi Hendrix nonsense at all.
Yeah.
I mean, poor guy. But I knew him as Jimmy James and the Blue Flame and all of that era.
And you also played on Keith Moon's solo album, right? His only solo album?
I did.
He must have been a heck of a guy, huh?
Marvelous character.
Marvelous character as well, yeah. You have any good Keith Moon stories hanging out with Keith?
Well, one day he, after a gig that we did, I went home. My beautiful wife, we're all curled up by the fire. Mm-hmm. Knock on the door, open the door. It's Keith Moon and Sha-na-na in their gold lamé outfits. And they all have blow-up Courvoisier bottles that they've talked some liquor store out of.
Mm-hmm.
And they're standing at my door.
Wow.
And that was it. That was pretty much it. But then the thing was that just to make up for kind of showing up unannounced, he made us a beautiful Indian meal, and that's part of Keith that a lot of folks, you know, the whole television out the window thing gets the big letters, but Keith was also a very good Indian cook. He could cook beautifully.
Wow. Huh. Well, very spicy or just kind of mild spice?
No, real Indian, the Indian
way. Real Indian cuisine, yeah. How did he show up with Sha-na-na? Where did that come from?
I mind not to ask questions. When he's managed to do it, I'm not going to start quizzing everybody.
Especially when it comes to Keith.
That's right. That's right.
John, here's a question that I ask everyone that I interview.
Yes.
I get some interesting answers. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, you know, like the movie, to perform, collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be? And I know you've been around a lot
Johnny
of...
Johnny Johnson. That'd be Johnny Johnson.
Johnny Johnson.
Yeah.
Really?
I had the opportunity to play with Johnny his last few years as a performer.
Yep.
And playing some of those great Chuck Berry songs with him playing. It was so such an talk about an out of body experience. That was one of mine.
Wow.
So yep. I think that's the same one that me and four or five other guys would want to have back.
Yeah. Good answer. Great answer.
Good.
So what? Just to wrap up, what do you got going on? New album in the works, maybe in the near future, or what's going on?
Sort of assembling some instruments, mainly to get ready for this little jug band outing that looks like it's in my future.
Yep.
And every now and then, one thing or another gets us into the studio, and sure enough, something will come out of it, but I can't ever anticipate when that will be or what it will be.
Yeah. Hopefully very soon.
Okay.
We need more great music from you. John, thank you so much, man, for being on the show, for all the incredible music you've given us, and we look forward to your upcoming dates, especially in Florida. Been great talking to you. Thank you so much. Take
Bye-bye.
Care. Bye-bye. For further information about John Sebastian, visit www.johnsebastian.com. Very special thanks to John's management, David Bendit, from David Bendit Artist, for setting up this interview with John Sebastian, and to Doug and Don Newsom with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Excuse me. Please join me bi-weekly Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552. Or email us at ray@publicityworksagency.com. Don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and the Wacky Family Business, or the second edition entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C. Available now at Amazon.com, and I promise you, you will live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by The Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio, Station 1.